Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 13, 2018, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, our conversation is on the Obama administration's Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule, known as the AFFH. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Stanley Kurtz, who is a Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. After hearing from Stanley, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us, Stanley. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much. All right, let's get right down to it. The Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Regulation has huge transformative potential. I think it's easily comparable to Obamacare. But very few people are talking about this or even understand the situation. And that's not entirely coincidental. The Obama administration, just as it did with Obamacare in delaying various controversial parts of the Obamacare legislation, they were careful not to really put AFFH fully into effect until after the 2016 election. That really was a task that was supposed to be left to Hillary. Didn't work out that way. And so what's happening now is that the Trump administration and Secretary Carson have essentially suspended their enforcement of AFFH, at least enforcement along the lines that the Obama administration would have done. So for the length of the Trump administration, AFFH will not be particularly consequential, at least as an administrative regulation. There may be court cases put down independently. But as soon as a Democrat president would get in, AFFH will be revived in more or less the form that it was envisaged by the Obama administration. And again, this will have potentially huge consequences. Now, I'm going to go through the basics here, but I want to refer you to a few pieces I've written about this issue if you want to go someplace to find something written down. I'm a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I'm also a contributing editor at National Review Online. If you Google my name and these titles I give you, you'll come up with the following three articles. The first one is called Attention America's Suburbs. You have just been annexed. So if you Google my name and annexed. Another one is called There is No Basis for Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Regulation in the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And another is called How Obama Stole Dubuque. So I'm drawing on a couple of those, and that's a good place to go. I'm a little bit rusty on this issue. I've refreshed myself before this teleforum simply because I've been focusing on campus free speech for the last year or two. But I've dipped back into the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing writings of myself and others, and we're going to move through it right now. Before I actually cover the regulation itself, I want to speak briefly about a crucial Supreme Court case that, in effect, green-lighted AFFH. This is Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs versus the Inclusive Community Project. It's a 2015 Supreme Court decision that came down on the very same day that Obergefell same-sex marriage decision came down. This was a surprise decision. The majority opinion was by Justice Kennedy, who people had thought would go the other way. Essentially, Texas Department of Public Housing declared that disparate impact claims are cognizable under the Fair Housing Act of 1968. That Fair Housing Act of 1968 is otherwise known as Title VIII of the Civil Rights Act of 1968. Now, Justice Kennedy gave people a couple of outs, you could say. If you, you're not allowed to have housing quotas, that's a legitimate use of illegitimate use of disparate impact, according to Justice Kennedy. And you have an opportunity to prove that your local housing policy is not really about race. Notwithstanding those conditions, Justice Kennedy said, most importantly, that zoning policy is what he called the heartland of legitimate disparate impact litigation. And so this decision effectively served as a green light for the Obama administration to finalize affirmatively furthering fair housing rule. And even though AFFH is often discussed as though it is only or primarily about zoning, AFFH is really, I would almost say, disparate impact on steroids. It really goes way beyond zoning. It goes way beyond housing to affect even local transportation decisions, even some local education decisions. There's almost no area of local government, no aspect of it, that is not potentially under federal control through affirmatively furthering fair housing. But it's certainly true that zoning is very central to the regulation. Now, the basic way in which it works is that local governments throughout the United States, often at the county or city, big city level or at the county level, receive grants from Department of Housing and Urban Development. Any HUD grant that comes to you makes you potentially liable to AFFH, but it's particularly the community development block grants that are widespread, and they're the easiest way to fall under the umbrella of AFFH. When a locality receives one of those grants, they have to sign a pledge, and part of that pledge says you agree to affirmatively further fair housing. Now, that's always been in the agreements that local governments sign. The difference is that the Obama administration has created, through this regulation, an extremely expansive definition of what affirmatively furthering fair housing means. Now, the first thing that happens if you are applying for a HUD grant under the new regulation is that you need to do a very detailed analysis of who lives where in your jurisdiction by race, by ethnicity, by national origin, by English proficiency, even handicap, I think, is included. And interestingly and importantly, by income, and we'll come back to this. Income is not a protected class, but it's thrown in there, and it's really very important, and it's legally problematic, I'll suggest. But anyway, you have to effectively map. You have to map your entire district, and what would make put your locality into danger is if there are what's called a racially concentrated area of poverty or a racially or ethnically concentrated area of poverty or any of these other groups. And that means if there is a particular area of, say, your county that has a high density of a particular ethnic group and also a high density of poverty in that same area, and certain percentages are given by the federal government, then you have a potential problem there. At that point, you have to submit a plan if you want to get your HUD grant for how you'll take steps to break up that racially or ethnically concentrated area of poverty. And that's one very powerful and important aspect of the regulation, but there's another more neglected aspect, which is at least as powerful. And that is, you've got to make a listing of all the community assets, it's called, community assets in your jurisdiction. What does that mean? It means high-quality schools, not just schools, but high-quality schools. Transportation hubs. Is there, say, a metro station, subway station, a bus station in your area, and if so, where is it, and how proximate is it to those racially or ethnically concentrated areas of poverty? What about parks? Are there parks in your jurisdiction, and are they close or far from the racially or ethnically concentrated areas of poverty? What about areas where lots of jobs are available? In other words, a kind of business district. So all of that has to be mapped. And any discrepancies in the availability of these desirable community assets to particular concentrations of poverty or ethnicity, again, puts you into potential problem with the federal government. And there are the truth is, of course, that there's no place that will not have something along these lines. I suppose there's that saying, I'm not a lawyer, you lawyers will know it better, I guess, that everyone commits three felonies a day or something like that. You know, there's no, I don't think there's a single jurisdiction that would come out clean in this estimation. So everyone potentially could have their money taken away, their HUD money taken away, maybe even have the federal government file a lawsuit against them. It's a question of how much or how quickly or slowly the federal government chooses to enforce all of this. And again, there are two key levers. One is that you risk losing your funds from HUD if you don't submit a plan to overcome these concentrations. And the other is that the federal government could threaten a lawsuit and force a locality to sign a consent decree. And sometimes these two levers work together. Now, one broad effect of the regulation is to move localities, including or especially suburbs, toward density. Density. That is to say, in practical terms, the best solution to this problem for a locality would be to build high-density, low-income housing, and then to put a transportation hub near that, and to locate the high-density housing near a business district where the jobs are available, and to build a park there or something like that. So, in effect, you're creating little downtowns, so to speak, in suburbs where people basically move to get away from urban living and to get to a different sort of living. So this is potentially has a, quite a transformative effect, and this is very intentional. There's a whole school of thought in urban planning called smart growth, and there are various other names for it, but the fashion now is to favor high density, located near transportation. Part of the idea behind that is to kind of force people out of their cars and get them to walk. So this is none of this is coincidental. It's part of a general philosophy of urban planning that dominated the Obama administration. Now, the survey, there's a tool that goes along with the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Regulation. When you fill out all of these forms and map everything in your district, the tool, I believe, working on memory here, is called the Assessment of Fair Housing, AFH. Maybe the Fair Housing Assessment, I may have reversed the wording, but it's something to that effect. And that tool, in my view, and I am not a lawyer, I'm speaking without that expertise, but in my view, that tool potentially creates significant legal jeopardy for a locality because, for example, after you have established where everyone lives by race, ethnicity, language competence, etc., if there are these imbalances, you're then supposed to attribute these imbalances to some cause, and a list of causes are provided. So, for example, one of the causes is zoning. Would you say that the zoning regulations help to explain this racial and ethnic imbalance? And it seems to me that if a locality puts a little check in that and says yes, because they're not thinking very clearly, it could amount to a kind of signed confession in a disparate action, a disparate impact lawsuit against that locality. And so there are some serious legal issues involved in even filling out one of these forms. And every locality that wants to get community development block grants, which is most counties or big cities in the country, is going to have to start filling these out as soon as the Democrat president gets in. Secretary Carson has withdrawn this tool, so no one's even filling it out right now. So let me give you an example. Even though I say that the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Regulation itself has not been applied, that's true. But it's also the case that the Obama administration has had what you could call some test runs of AFFH. Even before the regulation came out, they applied its basic principles in a couple of localities. One that I'm not going to have time to go into here, but that I referred you to at the beginning, is the case of Dubuque, Iowa. It's the less well-known case, but in some ways it's the more shocking and radical. But I'm actually going to focus right now on the Westchester County case, which is more well-known and which has helped me to illustrate certain things here. So what happened in the Westchester County was that a local civil rights organization in New York sued Westchester County for what's called false promise, because like every other locality that receives HUD grants, Westchester had signed its pledge to affirmatively further fair housing. And in the past, that never meant anything other than be vigilant against overt acts of discrimination in the housing market. But this civil rights group argued that affirmatively furthering fair housing had a much more expansive meaning, that it had to mean you would take steps as a jurisdiction to overcome these racial or ethnic concentrations of poverty. And so the judge decided in favor of the civil rights group. And then the Democrat county commissioner, the leader of the county who was Democratic in Westchester, went to appeal to the Obama administration to mediate the settlement, thinking that the Obama administration would hold back what it considered to be this sort of over-the-top unusual lawsuit. And instead, the Obama administration kind of stepped in and made this a test run of this new and more expansive interpretation of the duty to affirmatively further fair housing. So it forced the county, Westchester County, to sign a consent decree that many at the time and still considered draconian. They had to pledge to build quite a lot of high-density, low-income housing at the expense of the county, and then to what's called affirmatively advertise that that housing outside of the county. And the government expected Westchester to change its zoning away from single-family zoning to permit this high-density, low-income housing to be built. Westchester resisted that successfully for quite some time. But in effect, this kind of settlement means that that residents of a county are paying for the housing of people who don't actually live where the taxpayers in that county live. You're actually sort of advertising to bring people from the outside of your county into your county, and you're building them houses at the taxpayers' expense of your county. It's an extraordinary thing. What happened in Westchester is that the county was so upset by that, that this is a Democratic county predominantly, and Hillary and Bill Clinton live there, Chappaqua is in Westchester County. But it flipped in its government, and Rob Astorino, a Republican, took over, and he entered a prolonged battle with the federal government and the Obama administration over this. What's happening now is a little more murky. He may have given in somewhat, but he fought it for quite some time. But he was in a disadvantaged position because the commissioner before him had already signed the consent decree. But this raises what is really the most radical, I would say, aspect of affirmatively furthering fair housing. It really goes far beyond what I've said so far, far beyond the idea that just because your jurisdiction has a particular racial or ethnic concentration of poverty, you're in trouble. No, it goes way beyond that. It it implicates all local jurisdictions, all suburbs in the broader metropolitan region. It tends to have the effect of undermining the significance of the legal and political boundary between suburbs and the broader metropolitan region. This is often called regionalism. And I want to give just a little background on this before I get into the specifics. Basically, I got into this after studying the history of President Obama's work with community organizers. And it turns out that one of the themes that his community organizing mentors were focused on was the idea that the cities, the problems of the cities could be blamed essentially on the suburbs because people would move out to the suburbs and hurt the tax base of the city. So at first, they fell in with a group of academics who are still the inspiration of the regionalist movement, who advocated that cities annex their surrounding suburbs. This actually happened in the 1900s frequently. New York, a city, and Chicago were built through annexations. But in most states, annexations were made illegal without the consent of the locality being annexed. So at that point, the regionalist movement came up with some ways to create a kind of de facto annexation. Briefly, you block the creation of suburbs through things like development boundaries that we see in Portland. You try not to do a lot of repair on the highways. You make it inconvenient for people to get back and forth from suburbs, and that theoretically keeps suburbanites in the cities, would-be suburbanites in the cities. Then you, second step is you have low-income housing quotas that enable you to move urban residents out into the suburbs. The third component of this plan is something called regional tax base sharing, which exists now in reality only in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, but it's an aspiration of the regionalist movement to get that done more broadly. This is where all the municipalities in a greater metropolitan region kick in portions of their tax money to a common pot, which is then redistributed based on a demographic formula, and the gist of which means that the suburbs are redistributing their tax money to the cities and maybe to a few of the less well-off inner ring suburbs. So if you force suburbanites back into the city and you move people from the city out into the suburbs and you put all the tax money into a common pot, you've got a kind of de facto annexation. Well, there are different ways in which the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Regulation accomplishes all of these goals, but I'm going to focus on the most important. And that is when you do your obligatory demographic analysis when you're applying for HUD grants, when you fill out this assessment of fair housing, you're not just obligated to do an analysis of the demography of your county. You actually have to analyze your county's demography in comparison with the demography of the entire region. And so this means that if there is a racially or ethnically concentrated area of poverty somewhere else in your region, say in the large city at the center of your region, but that there are no serious imbalances in your county, you're nonetheless under obligation to recommend a plan to remedy that imbalance. So in effect, the AFFH regulation almost wipes out the political and economic significance of your suburb's boundary. It tends to regionalize the country, which is, again, the goal. But it really is a way of undercutting the federalist system. The big picture here is that the advocates of AFFH and of the regionalist school of thought want to move away from the traditional federalist system where you have the federal government and then the state government and then the local governments all nested, and move to a series of mega urban regions, the internal workings of which are managed ultimately by the federal government. And so this is a very ambitious goal that the biggest proponents of AFFH have in mind. Whether and to what extent they'll enforce AFFH to bring that about is an open question. I think we're going to see a kind of boiling the frog strategy. but I'm talking to you about the endpoint of the advocates. Now, there are, I don't want to take too much time, but I want to mention quickly two key legal issues. First of all, the beginning of AFFH itself includes a legal history. There is a claim in that history that the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Obligation was always in the Fair Housing Act of 1968, and that all AFFH does is to carry that out when the ball had been dropped effectively for decades by everyone else. This is wrong. This is nonsense in my view. I recognize that it can be argued. There is something of an argument for the other side, but there it's very problematic. There is only one brief phrase in the Fair Housing Act of 1968, almost in passing. It says the secretary, meaning Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, shall take steps to affirmatively further the purposes of the act. That's it. The rest of the act is all about preventing overt discrimination. There's nothing in there about sort of the housing equivalent of affirmative action. Now, advocates continually point to Walter Mondale, who was the Senate sponsor of the bill, who made a statement that we want to replace the ghetto by truly integrated and balanced living patterns. But what that really meant at the time was that it was believed that if you would eliminate overt discrimination, then you would get integration. To some degree, that's happened over time. The suburbs are more integrated than they used to be, substantially so. But because people don't always have the money to move where they want to move, or because sometimes people want to cluster by ethnic group, elimination of overt discrimination in housing has not led to integration. But Mondale himself now has fallen in with the AFFH people and likes to claim this. But we have other quotes by Mondale that make it pretty clear this is actually not what he meant. And most of the there is dispute, but in my view, the better histories of the Fair Housing Act show pretty conclusively that AFFH is a wild overinterpretation. However, the lower courts have attempted, and to some degree the Supreme Court, but much more so the lower courts, have attempted to fill in a meaning for affirmatively furthering fair housing that more approximates what these advocates want. It, to me, it's a classic case in which original Civil Rights Act, which intended to prevent discrimination, has been transformed over time. Key cases that you might want to look up, and this is not where my expertise is, but just for your information, Trafficante versus Metropolitan Life, 1972, NAACP Boston versus HUD, 1987. There are two cases called GAUTREAU, GAUTREAUX. I don't have the dates on those. There's another important case, Otero versus New York City Housing Authority. I'm going to skip. We could maybe come back to it, but the Secretary Romney was an important figure in this historical issue we could maybe come back to. I want to touch on one other issue, and that is, I alluded to it before, economic integration. There is no legal requirement for economic integration in the United States of America, only for prevention of discrimination by race. But really, AFFH is a kind of subterranean way of creating economic integration. Poverty is not a protected class. And when you identify a racially or ethnically concentrated area of poverty, you are doing something that really goes beyond the law, and the defenses that the advocates of AFFH have given for including poverty in this are very weak. I can go into them if you want in questioning period. But also, insofar as this has been polled, and it hasn't been extensively, but insofar as people have been polled as to whether they think it's the job of the government to prevent economic discrimination in housing or economically integrate localities, the public overwhelmingly thinks that's no business of the government. So it seems to me, not being a lawyer, but it seems to me that the rule itself might be vulnerable to a legal challenge on these grounds. Now, I see we're already at 3:30. I was going to say a little bit more about the current state of the rule and about the politics of all this, but I could do that, or we could flip over to questions. And if the questions stop, I could maybe finish with a little bit on the current state of the rule and on the politics of this if it didn't come up in questioning.
Thanks, Stanley. I agree. I think that's a good way to proceed. Let's go ahead and open up the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter the star and then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Well, we already have a question lined up, so let's move to our first participant.
Hello, I'm Mary Maxwell here. I'm in Australia at the moment. That was a real shock.
I can't hear this very well.
Caller, if you could find a way to speak closer to the microphone or turn.
Is this any better?
Yes.
This is better, yes.
I said your speech is a real shocker, and I'm glad that you give it to us when it's not a hot issue, you know, when you don't have to run around for the next 5 days trying to reach your congressman. My question is, what part of Article 1 grants of power to Congress do you think they might be imagining to cover this?
Well, I've run into Philip Hamburger a couple of times at events, and I keep trying to tell him that he should look into affirmatively furthering fair housing, that it might be of real interest to him, and he's invited me to write him about it, and I've never taken him up on it. It does seem to be a gigantic overreach of effectively doing something legislative. But, I mean, this is so not simply because of all of the ambitious things that are asked, but because, as I have argued, none of this really falls legitimately under the purview of what was intended by the Fair Housing Act by the phrase affirmatively further fair housing. So it really is a classic case of administrative overreach, of the administrative state, of bursting out of the confines of your legislative writ. It's about as bad as it gets, but people don't know about it because, there are a couple reasons they don't know. First, because it's not being enforced, but also because of the politics of it. I'll hold back on that for now and see if there are other questions, and if there aren't, I'll go into the politics that explain why you don't hear all that much about this incredibly ambitious rule, which you would think would be widely debated, but it's not, and I think there are reasons for that.
We do have another caller lined up for a question. Without further ado, let's move to the next participant.
Stanley, this is Stuart Gerson. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
You may recall that I was the lead counsel for Westchester County.
Oh!
And while your analysis is spot on, you really didn't describe the most onerous part of it of all, and that is the case was brought not as a question of regulatory enforcement, but it was brought under the Federal False Claims Act, which is a treble damages statute. I was able to get the government involved in it for purposes of settlement, so that while the consent decree part of it is annoying, the monetary part of it was reduced to something much more tolerable than the $210 million that Judge Coates' opinion sustaining the use of the False Claims Act in this irrelevant way would have wrought. So I just wanted to offer that. I mean, the subsequent administration has not attempted to do anything like that, and one hopes that that doesn't happen. One further thing, though, is in terms of this question of demographic manipulation that undergirded the secretary's opinion on the subject and these interest groups opinion on the subject. It was very clear that, you know, in many cases they wanted affirmative action in communities that were far away from any place where minorities lived and worked or could get to by the sorts of transportation that they used, and in direct opposition to what a number of civil rights organizations wanted, which was increased new housing in areas of high minority density. In other words, people wanted to live pretty much with people like themselves.
Yes, those are all great points. Let me make some comments. I mean, I did mention the false claims, but I, not being a lawyer, I don't have the understanding that you do. I had no idea that a false claims claim means you get treble damages. So that's very disturbing and interesting angle on this. And I also want to pick up on some of the things you said at the end, which are tremendously important. First of all, it is absolutely true, although very few people understand this, that there is great internal division within the civil rights movement. It's true that on this issue, it's true that the dominant strains within civil rights organizations favor this regionalist position. They favor moving people out of racially and ethnically concentrated areas of poverty, to use the AFFH language, and into the suburbs. But there are quite a few civil rights advocates who think that this is not a great idea, or that it's been focused on way too much. And basically, some of these advocates of what are called community development corporations, will propose a new high-density, low-income housing in an urban area that already has such developments. And this has various advantages. You can build more for your money. There is less internal opposition. It tends to turn abandoned properties that have become centers of crime into a better, more productive area that actually helps the community. It also puts a burden on people in a community to move them out to somewhere else, that they're the ones that have to move, and that they have to go into a place that maybe they feel alien and not in place. So there's a lot of internal opposition over this. And I also want to pick up on what Stuart Gerson said about imposing this on areas where there's no plausible argument that the minorities are in ordinary commuting distance of the relevant suburb. This takes me back to the Dubuque issue. Again, I reference that piece on Dubuque. Dubuque is, in a way, the most shocking example of all this. What you had in Dubuque was a situation where the Department of Housing and Urban Development engaged in a program called HOPE 6. That's 6 with a Roman numeral, HOPE 6. And HOPE 6 was essentially the intentional demolition of the heavily built housing, high-rise housing projects, which had become crime-ridden and all of that in Chicago. They demolished those, and they never fully replaced them. And so, therefore, the people who used to live there didn't have good housing to go to. Now, it was decided that many of those people should go to Iowa. And one of the first examples of this was Dubuque. Now, Dubuque is maybe 4 or 5 hour commute on a good day from Chicago, and obviously it's not even in the same state. It is quite a stretch to call Dubuque part of the greater Chicago region, and yet this was implicitly done, and they went in and they went after Dubuque. Dubuque, which was having its own troubles after the 2008 crisis, had pensioners and other people who were financially strapped who wanted to get into the limited amount of low-income housing that was used there. And Dubuque created a kind of hierarchy. If you want to get into the low-income housing in Dubuque, you get more points if you're a resident and taxpayer of Dubuque. Makes sense. And if you're not, but you're from Iowa, you get some points too. If you're from out of state, you get the least number of points. Well, the federal government came in, said that because most of the people out of state who might want to do this are African American, this is a disparate impact discrimination, and they forced a consent decree on Dubuque, And as a result, huge number of former public housing tenants from Chicago moved to Dubuque. And this shows you that the attempt to move from the traditional federal, state, locality, federalist system is so ambitious that it literally puts greater metropolitan regions over states, the political boundaries of states, in addition to suburbs, in importance.
Stanley, we don't have any current questions lined up, so if you would like to, you had mentioned various points earlier that you'd like to get to once the questions slowed down, so I'll leave it up to you for which point you'd like to address first.
Absolutely. So first of all, as we've all said several times, AFFH is not currently being enforced, at least not in the way that the Obama administration envisaged. Now, there have been reports that the omnibus funding bill that passed Congress recently included a rider that effectively, for the time being, gutted AFFH. The rider says that HUD cannot direct grantees to make specific zoning changes. But this, in fact, does absolutely nothing to prevent the enforcement of AFFH, and it's a good example of the, I would say, insidiousness of some of what goes on here. Federal law already technically forbids the Department of Housing and Urban Development from specifically directing local governments to change their policies. That is the technical acknowledgement of the federal lines of authority in the federalist system. But HUD and the federal government are able to get around that, and the way they do it is they don't tell you what to do. What they say instead is, once you've made this analysis and shown all of these demographic disparities in your district and in your region, then you have to submit a plan, which is defined as a voluntary plan. In what so-called voluntary ways are you going to try to overcome these? And you're allowed to choose from a large menu. So that might include changing zoning regulations and building high-density, low-income housing, but it also might include building a new subway or bus station near an area of racially concentrated area of poverty. So they don't tell you to do any one thing, but they demand that if you want the money, you have to propose a plan to remedy what they consider to be the demographic problem, and then you don't get the money unless HUD approves it. So it's like saying someone wants you to jump over the fence, and they never actually say to you, you must jump over the fence if you want to get this money I have for you. But it becomes clear through a series of hand signals and suggestions that you'll get the money when you jump over the fence. So basically, nothing has happened to stop AFFH from reemerging when the next Democrat administration comes in. Now, I want to say, and also there is a lawsuit, and I'm not an expert on this lawsuit, I haven't followed it closely, but there is a lawsuit prominently touted by the New York Times, by various fair housing groups, who are suing Secretary Carson for failure to enforce AFFH. I have not studied that. I don't know whether they have a case. I mean, I know that I don't like AFFH, but to what extent is whatever Secretary Carson doing within legitimate regulatory flexibility, and to what extent has he overstepped that? I really don't know. But it's important to know that there is a lawsuit going on that has been filed about all of this. But now I want to say something about the larger politics of this, unless there's another question. Mike, is there a question?
There actually is another question on the line.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and move to that one right now.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, this is Steve McIntyre. I'm from Baltimore County, and I'm sorry I jumped on the call late, but we've been hit with kind of a precursor to one of the AFFH suits that was settled in 2016. and we're up for review in 2020. We only get $3.9 million in ESG and CDBG funds, which is what I understand obligates us to participate in this process on a regional basis.
Yes.
And I was wondering of you know, kind of case studies of entities or jurisdictions that withdrew as a HUD entitlement. In other words, we could say, we don't want your $3.9 million, and we don't want to go through this again. That $3.9 million ended up costing us $30 million in the 2016 settlement. So,
right.
You know, it hasn't been a very profitable entity being receiving HUD money.
Yes, and I've tried to tell people this. I went on a kind of a tear at National Review Online where I've written about this and basically argue that jurisdictions should not apply for HUD money, that it's not worth it, it's too dangerous at this point. As best I understand it, your grant from HUD could be $1, but you'd still be liable because the $1, even $1, would obligate you to sign. I don't know how late you jumped in, but you've got to sign an agreement that says you agree to affirmatively further fair housing. And once you sign that agreement, you can be sued just as Westchester County was sued for false claims, or in any case, you're under a legal obligation to take even $1 because you sign that agreement. Now, there is a county in Colorado, Douglas County. Where activists have prevailed upon the county not to apply. I testified before, I was going to testify. It's a little complicated. I probably shouldn't go into the background politics too much, but because people in Forsyth County knew about my writing, they invited me to testify, and somehow through a series of indirect acts, that convinced some reluctant county commissioners in Forsyth County, Georgia, not to apply for a HUD grant. They had only just become eligible. They had only just gone over a certain line of population that allowed them to apply. I don't know whether Douglas County in Colorado had already been getting funds or if they just declined. I think they'd already been getting them and then they decided not to. There's a group, an organized group out there that was pushing them not to. So I don't know, though, what it would mean. I don't know what it would mean if you just say, we don't want to do this anymore. A couple of things about that. Probably that would be very helpful to you. On the other hand, my sense of it is, and I'm not a lawyer, as I explained to people, but there are really two ways, as I said, that the federal government can come at you. One is to take away your HUD grant, and the other one is to threaten to sue you or to actually sue you and force you through that into a consent decree or actually go through the suit. And so they might, I think it would scare them a lot if Baltimore were to try to get out of this through simply not applying anymore for HUD grants because it is a good strategy. And so I would think that would give them a motivation to try to sue you regardless of whether you had applied for the HUD grant. It would be harder for them. It's easier for them if you sign the agreement that says you've agreed to affirmatively further fair housing. But they, precisely because it's a good idea what you're suggesting, they might want to go at you to make an example of you, because if you succeed in not applying for the grant and getting out of it that way, you could do what I want to see happen, which is to start a kind of movement, to be a domino that starts a national movement where districts stop applying for these grants. And I don't believe it would stay at that. I believe the existence of the movement would create massive political pressure that would force a withdrawal or a revision of the rule itself, because it would become a huge story that people were now too afraid to even apply for these. So I would love to see you not apply, but I would think that they would try to go after you legally just because they'd be so afraid of the precedent you'd set.
And we have another question in the queue. So without further ado, we move on to the next caller.
Hi, Stanley. This is Lee O'Connor. Thank you very much for doing this. I remember a couple of years ago being positively horrified when I learned about this program and its implications and application. What Who commented when this? You said it was regulation, so I'm assuming it came out under the Administrative Procedure Act and was subject to public notice and comment. Who commented and what did they say?
That is a great question, and I would again say that although it's far from a comprehensive answer to your question, if you go to the piece I recommended at the very beginning, you Google my name and then Google some part of the title, Attention America's Suburbs, You Have Just Been Annexed. If you even just Google my name and the word annexed, you'll probably come up with this article. And what I do in the article is I go through the full version of the rule, which is the rule with all of the comments that were made, and then it has all the answers to the comments. So when I, for example, I said earlier in the call that some of the commenters who had said, wait a minute, poverty is not a protected class. And then in the other article I referenced at the beginning, the one where I say there's no basis, Stanley Kurtz.
Yeah, sorry, I missed the very beginning of the call.
Oh, yes. The one where I say there's no basis, I discussed the commenters and the very weak reply that the commenters forced on this issue of economic integration. It was a very weak reply. But broadly speaking, there were several groups of commenters. The most active commenters were the fair housing organizations. All of their comments were to try to strengthen the rule, to try to say, well, the rule really ought to do this and it should push further. And then the second group were members of government officials. The gist of their comments was, you know, this is very onerous, you know, can you make this a little bit more efficient and less burdensome for us? And then there were conservative-leaning opponents of the rule who said clever things like, you know, poverty is not a protected class, and forced them to make, I think, a revealing and embarrassing reply. But it's and so both of those pieces that I talked about are made possible by the comments and the answers. And I was only able, when it finally came out, it was 300 or 400 double-spaced pages with all the comments and replies. And I didn't go through all of them. I focused on certain what I considered key issues. But if you really get interested in this, it's incredibly useful to go through all the comments and all the replies.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And we don't have any other questions lined up, so we can return to your previous remarks, Stanley.
Absolutely. I wanted to talk a little bit again about the politics of this. One of the reasons, I think, maybe the most important reason really, why AFFH is not much discussed is that each political party has reasons not to want to talk about it. When you hear all this, you might think to yourself, well, this is, you know, outrageous. This is the ultimate government overreach. I mean, how can this even have happened? And if the Republicans mention this and bring this up, it would most certainly help them politically. And I actually think that that's true. but the reason I failed to make that case is that, and it's pretty obvious, that, you know, Republican legislators don't, or politicians don't want to talk about this because they'll instantly be accused of racism. And whenever this is written about in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and it's almost always written about only by quoting experts, you know, who favor the rule, and by, you know, in a credulous way, reporting the, in my view, thoroughly misguided story that this is all just doing what the original Fair Housing Act said. You know, it poses this all as elementary, necessary integration going back to classic civil rights work of the 60s, instead of what it actually is, which is a massive overreach, overinterpreting something that no longer has anything to do with preventing discrimination, but instead actually sort of dictating from the center where people should live, which is something we don't do in a free society. But Republicans are too afraid to make that case because they don't want to be accused of being racist. It really comes down to that. On the Democratic side, the housing groups The fair housing groups and the civil rights organizations are deeply invested in this, and they have some key political allies. But the Democrats understand very well that when the general public understands this, it will not go well for the Democrats politically. You remember earlier I explained how Westchester County, which is a predominantly liberal Democrat area of New York, flipped politically and turned to a Republican precisely because they were outraged by the Obama administration's actions in this case. And this could really happen on a national basis if and when a Democrat comes in and actually begins to enforce AFFH. Now, I think a Democratic president would be caught in a little bit of a vice here. On the one hand, he would be heavily pressured by the New York Times and the Washington Post and by all of the constituencies who care about this within the party to move on it aggressively. And on the other hand, at least a sensible Democratic president would understand that there was tremendous political risk in this. And so, again, I think they'll revert to a kind of boiling the frog strategy. They'll be able to go after any place they want, but they'll be very selective and slow and not try to scare the frog into jumping out of the pot. And so the result of all this is that we don't hear a lot about AFFH, even though it is this truly transformative and massive regulation, but neither party wants to talk about it. It's a little bit like the same-sex marriage dispute was. You know, there was a dynamic there that neither side wanted to be perceived as the aggressor, so to speak, as the one that was pushing against the other too much. They wanted to be reactive. So we have this truly enormous transformative change, which no one is talking about and very few people know about, except conservatives who read me at National Review Online, which is a not trivial universe, but as I've learned, very far from being salient in America's political universe at the same time.
And still having no questions in the queue, Stanley, I'll give you an opportunity for some closing remarks.
Well, I think we pretty much covered it there, covered the basics. We need people to work on this. I've been working on campus free speech for a year and a half, and I sort of was asked to do this, and I feel an obligation to it. But I think it speaks ill for our side that you've only got me. I mean, I might be a nice guy, and obviously Westchester County had Stuart Gerson as his attorney, and that's great. But we need experts on this. We need law review articles that make the case that the history that's touted about AFFH is not the right history. And we need, you know, clever cases to be brought when the rule is enforced and plaintiffs come forward to say, you know, this is economic integration and that's not in the law. This is potentially a growth area if a Democrat president comes in and really does something about it. And there are very few people on our side in my experience. So, you know, there's a growth opportunity for someone out there, I guess is what I'd say.
Absolutely. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.